You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Welcome to our third of three podcasts on breast cancer hosted by Med Learning Group. This three-part series is titled Tailoring Treatment for Patients with HR-Positive, HER2-Negative Metastatic Breast Cancer, Examining the Role of Current and Emerging Endocrine Therapies. The program is geared towards members of the multidisciplinary care team who manage breast cancer, including medical oncologists, advanced practice providers, and pharmacists in both academic and community settings. In this episode, we'll be talking about molecular testing methods to detect mutations in patients with HR-positive, HER2-negative metastatic breast cancer, and touching on some of the current treatment strategies. My name is Chris, and I'll be the host of today's podcast. Joining me today is Dr. Sarah Hurvitz. Dr. Hurvitz is a professor of medicine, Smith Family Endowed Chair in Women's Health, head of the Division of Hematology and Oncology, and Senior Vice President of the Clinical Research Division at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center at the University of Washington. Dr. Hurvitz has been routinely involved in clinical trials for emerging therapies throughout her career and has been a speaker and faculty member for many educational events around the world. Dr. Hurvitz, welcome to our discussion.
Thank you, Chris. Super happy to be here today with you.
So, really quickly, just introduce yourself. How long have you been a caregiver in breast cancer, and how did you end up becoming so involved in clinical trials for medical therapy?
Yeah, I actually began treating breast cancer exclusively around 19 years ago. My fellowship research work was actually focused on lymphoma. I thought I was going to be a lymphoma specialist and did bench and translational work in lymphoma during my fellowship training. And at that point, I began working on better understanding how monoclonal antibodies worked in lymphoma. So I had lab-based projects using mice and doing experiments to see how we could make targeted therapy for lymphoma work better. And my mentor at the time allowed me to get involved in a first-in-human study of a brand new immune therapy at the time. And so I was able to be involved in consenting and treating patients on a clinical trial, and I found that to be an incredibly rewarding part of the work of an oncologist, to be able to see the research that was done in the laboratory actually affect patients clinically. And so when I was invited to transition and my role and really focus on breast cancer when I was hired as faculty, I was super interested in continuing my work as a clinical translational researcher. That's really where it all began.
Well, thanks for that introduction. We're super happy to have you on board with us for this podcast today. Now, I wanted to start with molecular testing methods to detect mutations in patients with breast cancer. So let's just start with, what is a liquid biopsy, and how and when do you use them in clinical practice?
Yeah, liquid biopsies are becoming more and more common in clinical practice now. And what liquid refers to is blood or components of the blood. Typically we would take a sample of a solid tumor and look at the solid tumor to detect where did it start and are there protein receptors expressed that would help us understand how better to treat that particular tumor. And then more recently, work was done to detect mutations in that biopsy sample. But doing a biopsy of a solid tumor involves oftentimes imaging and invasive procedures like needle biopsies and occasionally open biopsies. We know that tumors can shed parts of the DNA into the blood and can be detected simply by a blood test. And this omits the need to actually sample a solid tumor with a more invasive procedure and allows us to repeatedly sample the blood to see if new mutations have developed in the tumor that might be actionable or targetable with the targeted therapy.
So using this circulating tumor DNA or other assays, how important is it to actually identify these mutations? Is knowing whether or not there's a certain mutation necessary before you can actually advise a patient on a particular treatment?
Well, it really depends on the setting that you're talking about. We don't typically use circulating tumor DNA in the early stage setting as part of our standard clinical practice. So if a patient's being treated in the curative setting, we should not be testing them by liquid biopsies outside of the context of a clinical trial. However, in the metastatic disease setting, we are utilizing liquid biopsy, especially for hormone receptor positive, HER2 negative metastatic breast cancer, where we have the availability of several agents that have been FDA approved for treatment based on the presence of a mutation, for example, PIK3CA mutations.
So you just alluded to this in your past answer, but are there actual testing recommendations for these biomarkers in breast cancer?
Yeah, absolutely. And the field is evolving quickly. So what I just said about not using liquid biopsies in early stage disease, that's as of today. In the future, we may see updates in our guidelines as to when we should be doing liquid biopsy. But for now, it is recommended that we should biopsy a patient's tumor at the time of their first recurrence of disease when it's metastatic to retest those protein biomarkers, ER, PR, and HER2, and also to test for PIK3CA mutation status. At the time of progression, liquid biopsy can be done to evaluate for a mutation in the gene encoding the estrogen receptor, or ESR1, and also to look for other actionable mutations, for example, PI3 kinase pathway mutations in AKT, PI3 kinase, ESR1, as well as rarer mutations, including ERBB2 and NTRK mutations. We can test tumor tissue if ctDNA is negative. In some patients, the tumor does not shed ctDNA, and so you have to test the tumor to look for some of those actionable mutations.
So let's shift over to treatment for a minute or two. And this is something we could probably spend many podcasts on. But there's a bunch of new therapies that have been released in the past several years. Why all these new therapies all of a sudden? What are some of the limitations of previous treatments up until recently?
Yeah, we are in an era where it seems that we have an FDA approval every 6 months or so for breast cancer, which is a great thing. It's an embarrassment of riches, if you will. But the reason there is so much work toward discovering new therapies for hormone receptor positive metastatic breast cancer is the fact that virtually all patients will experience disease progression on endocrine-based approaches. And so scientists have been looking at what pathways are active and implicated in the development of resistance to these therapies. And they've detected a number of mutations. For example, in the PI3 kinase AKT-mTOR pathway, there are a number of alterations that can lead to upregulation of that pathway, which allows the tumors to become resistant even in the absence of estrogen. And so that has led to a number of therapies being developed and discovered.
So knowing this background on endocrine resistance, just give us a brief rundown of some of the agents or the classes of agents that can be used for hormone receptor positive, HER2 negative metastatic breast cancer.
Absolutely. And this is becoming a complicated area now, given the number of agents available. In a patient who has experienced a recurrence of their disease and it's now metastatic or has developed de novo metastatic ER-positive breast cancer, we have a number of agents that target the hormone receptor or the hormone receptor pathway, which include aromatase inhibitors, estrogen receptor down regulators, for example, fulvestrant, which is given intramuscularly, or elacestrant, which is given orally, or SERM, which is tamoxifen. We typically do not use the majority of these agents in the first line setting without an additional partner. The standard of care now is in almost all cases to pair one of these endocrine therapies with a cyclin-dependent kinase 4-6 inhibitor, such as abemaciclib, palbociclib, or ribociclib. So doublet therapy really is the standard of care. in some patients whose disease has a PI3 kinase pathway mutation, we have the ability to utilize an inhibitor of that pathway. Agents under this classification include alpelisib, inavolisib, and capivasertib. All three of these agents are restricted to the use in patients who have a mutation in this pathway. And then we have an mTOR inhibitor, everolimus. Everolimus was FDA approved about 13 years ago, and it can be used with endocrine therapy in patients, regardless of whether or not their tumor has a PI3 kinase pathway mutation.
So I kind of wanted to segue into ASCO. This past ASCO meeting in June, a lot of the agents you just mentioned were discussed in various clinical trials at ASCO, as well as some investigational ones. On another podcast, we talked about some of the clinical trial results that were released at ASCO in 2025. Some of these included the INAVO 120 study, the SERENA-6, which looked at camizestrant. There are also some patient-reported outcomes from EMBER-3 of imlunestrant. What do you think are a couple of the most important takeaways from this past ASCO meeting?
Yeah, it was a really interesting ASCO meeting. I think there was a lot of buzz about the fact that the INAVO 120 study, which looked at inavolisib in combination with palbociclib and fulvestrant, did demonstrate a significant improvement in overall survival for patients with PIK3CA mutated ER positive metastatic breast cancer. I would just call out that this particular trial did enroll a very select patient population. The patient population was defined by strict glucose requirements when the patients entered. So they had to have a low HbA1c and fasting plasma glucose. And the other restriction was that patients had to have their disease progress while on or within 12 months of adjuvant endocrine therapy. So this is not therapy that is approved for patients with de novo metastatic breast cancer or for those patients who experienced recurrence after being off of an AI for over a year. All that said, these data were really compelling and do show significant benefits for patients who fall into those eligibility criteria. And this is a group of patients who really have quite poor outcomes by just using the CDK4/6 inhibitor and endocrine therapy. I think the EMBER-3 PRO data was very reassuring that patients feel well on imlunestrant. And then we saw with VERITAC-2 some phase 3 results of vepdegestrant versus fulvestrant, showing benefits really in the ESR1 mutated population, which is similar to what we saw in Emerald with elacestrant, which also targets ER. I think the data overall were very interesting and supportive of the fact that we have a number of agents available for our patients with ER-positive metastatic breast cancer. How to sequence these agents and select among them is something that we continue to debate and deal with in the clinic, and it does require nuanced decision-making in cooperation with our patients.
So let's end on this, and you just kind of alluded to it here. Breast cancer is an extremely fluid type of cancer in terms of endocrine resistance, mutations, and the evolution of treatments, all of which we discussed. There's a lot of information to consolidate. So for this podcast, what are some of your final thoughts on maybe where we are with medical therapy for HR-positive, HER2-negative metastatic disease? Should we be encouraged? Are there ongoing unmet needs for patients and clinicians?
I think we should absolutely be encouraged because the pace of discovery for this type of breast cancer, which is more than half of all breast cancer diagnosed in the metastatic setting, it's really quite good. I think we are moving the needle on improving patients' outcomes, including patient-reported outcomes. We know that endocrine-based therapy, when combined with CDK4/6 inhibitors, outperforms chemotherapy. So in my lifetime, I've seen us move away from the use of chemotherapy for ER-positive disease, even in patients with symptomatic visceral metastases. And I think that's a big win for patients that our targeted therapies are doing better than cytotoxic chemotherapy. I think also the fact that we are getting more and more refined from a molecular standpoint in selecting therapies that are based on what is driving the tumor biology. That is good news for patients as well, because going after what is wrong with the tumor will help us selectively target the tumor and hopefully spare normal cells. There are challenges that remain, as I alluded to, deciding among these agents. We may have two oral SERDs available in the not too distant future. How do we use ctDNA to monitor disease response, and should we be doing that? How do we make sure that our patients are feeling well on the therapies that we're giving them, and how do we design trials that help us define therapies for broad populations of patients to make sure that our efficacy translates into true effectiveness for our patients. So there's a lot of open areas that require further studying, but a lot of hope as well.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Hurvitz. Based on our discussion, you've made it very clear that staying on top of the constantly changing treatment environment for breast cancer is a critical aspect of care. But that we should all be encouraged with where we're at. And I'm very glad to hear that. But that's all the time we have for today. I would like to thank our expert, Dr. Sarah Hurvitz, for taking the time out of her day to speak with us. And thanks to all of our listeners for joining us. Hopefully you're able to tune into other podcasts in this series, in which we'll explore additional topics in breast cancer. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group. MedLearning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. I would also like to give a special thank you to our educational grant supporter, Lily, who provided an unrestricted educational grant for this activity. Thank you very much, and have a great day.